You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code SPOTIFY for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
This episode is brought to you by Reese's Peanut Butter Cups. In breaking news, leading scientists worldwide are conducting experiments to determine if Reese's Peanut Butter Cups are the perfect combination of peanut butter and chocolate. However, it appears the study was inconclusive, as the scientists couldn't help but eat all the Reese's. Because when you want something sweet, you can't do better than Reese's. Find Reese's now at a store near you.
Monster House presents.
Monster Talk can be supported by listeners like you at patreon.com/monstertalk or by leaving positive reviews on iTunes and other podcasting sites. Learn more at monstertalk.org/support. Thanks to all of you who are supporting us in this way. We are humbled and grateful and hope that we always live up to or exceed your expectations.
What is it? Some sort of computer game?
In a sense, except it uses the most powerful processor known to man, the human mind.
You're not playing.
I'm not a player, but I am playing.
He sort of tells us what's happening.
I will be your guide. Through my words, you will experience the land of Elfenheart, from the mighty mountains that border the goblin wastelands to the sewers that run like a spiderweb through the city of Jandor. I, gentlemen, will be your eyes.
It's actually quite unlike anything we've ever seen before.
A giant, hairy creature, part ape, part man.
In Loch Ness, a 24-mile-long bottomless lake in the highlands of Scotland, it's a creature known as the Loch Ness Monster.
Monster Talk.
Welcome to Monster Talk, the science show about monsters. I'm Blake Smith.
And I'm Karen Stolzner.
In the summer of 2016, America was captivated by the adventures of a plucky gang of kids in the imaginary town of Hawkins, Indiana. Their story, the plot of the series, centered around a secret government facility that conducted illegal and unethical experiments resulting in horrific paranormal outcomes. The main plot of the show was built on real events like the CIA's efforts at mind control and fictional events like the legends around something called the Montauk Project. We will likely dig into that stuff more in the future, but before any of Stranger Things' main plot begins, we're given a smaller narrative centered around a gaming table in the basement of one of the protagonists' suburban home. We're going to go to a clip, but be advised, the kids here have potty mouths.
Something is coming. Something hungry for blood. A shadow grows on the wall behind you, swallowing you in darkness. It is almost here.
What is it?
What if it's the Demogorgon? Oh, Jesus, we're so screwed if it's the Demogorgon.
It's not the Demogorgon.
An army of troglodytes charge into the chamber.
Troglodytes?
Told ya.
Wait a minute. Did you hear that? That sound. Boom. Boom. Ow! That didn't come from the troglodytes. Oh. No, that came from something else. The Demogorgon!
Deep shit.
Will, your action!
I don't know.
Fireball him! I have to roll a 13 or higher.
Too risky. Cast a protection spell.
Don't be a pussy. Fireball him!
Cast protection.
The Demogorgon is tired of your silly human bickering. It stops towards you. Boom! Fireball him, Will!
No, stop!
Boom!
Cast protection.
It was in anger!
And fireball!
And fireball!
So, Did you hear the names of those monsters? Troglodytes? Demogorgon? For many people, these are not just names for cave-dwelling prehistoric peoples or for a specific demon mentioned in Milton. As an interesting aside, current theory is that the name Demogorgon was actually created when someone misspelled the Greek word demiurge, the name of the creator of the physical world within Gnostic Christianity. Rather than acknowledging a typo, subsequent readers deduced that it meant something special. That's so covfefe. Statistically, it's likely most people today encounter these words in the context of Dungeons & Dragons. D&D is the foundational framework for the modern role-playing game ecosystem. Or maybe that's geekosystem. But the foundational book for dispensing information about monsters in that game is the Monster Manual. Today, we're going to talk about the history of that book and of role-playing games. And we know that not all of our listeners are gamers, and not all of Monster Talk's hosts are either. So today, I'll be playing the role of a gamer, and Karen will be the proxy questioner for all you non-gamers out there. And we have a fantastic guide for this adventure, author John Peterson, whose book, Playing at the World, has been used as a course text for understanding the history of the modern role-playing game phenomenon. We'll be discussing monsters and gaming, so you know you're in for some
Monster Talk.
Today, we're going to be talking with John Peterson, who's the author of Playing at the World, a history of simulating wars, people, and fantastic adventures from chess to role-playing games. And he was also a contributor to the recent retrospective volume looking at the game Dungeons & Dragons, Art and Arcana, A Visual History, which is an absolutely gorgeous book. I think, to be blunt, Monster Manual was a gateway to the world of mythology and monsters to many of our listeners. And long before many of them had even read myths or the sort of fictional volumes that sort of informed that book, they were reading about the stats of monsters to play role-playing games. But now we have this opportunity to talk to someone, because I've been trying to find someone to talk about the Monster Manual, the D&D game book, the Monster Manual. And I was reaching around to different people, and Ken Height said, "Don't talk to me, talk to John Peterson. He's the guy to get." And so we reached out to you, and I'm so glad that you decided to join us. So welcome to Monster Talk.
Oh, well, thanks so much for having me, Blake and Karen. Yeah, and it's obviously very flattering that Ken Height would direct you guys to me. That's awesome.
We presume that you came to gaming as a gamer, but I know that sounds strange, but like somehow you've moved beyond that and have become sort of an expert on gaming itself and chronicling the sort of historical way that it came to be what it is now. How did that path happen?
Yeah, so I mean, the story I typically tell about this, which I think is mostly true, is that back in 2004, something really traumatic happened to a lot of gamers. A game was released called World of Warcraft, and it kind of took over our lives and made us unable to do anything for a considerable amount of time afterwards. And some friends of mine staged an intervention, actually. We were going to England to go to an indie rock festival there, but we were staying over in London for a couple of days. And while we were there, I was in the British Museum, and I happened to see in a display case this first century AD Roman 20-sided die.
Nice.
And, I kind of had this moment then where I wondered just how far back everything went, how far back the things I was like living in World of Warcraft went. And kind of the thing I immediately seized upon actually is the question, okay, there must have been someone in history who was like the first person to roll a die against some kind of a statistical model, a chart that would decide fictional events based on the outcome of the die roll. And who was it? And I was like, somebody must have written the book about this. Somebody must have figured this out long ago. And so I went looking for it. And that was the path that led me to where I am today, more or less, is that, I got super obsessed with answering that in a set of related questions. And the time that I had been squandering on World of Warcraft kind of quickly transitioned into time I was now squandering on vast amounts of historical research. And within a couple of years, I knew I was going to do Playing at the World. And once that came out, I just kind of got caught up in this.
So I think we've established already that I'm not a gamer. So all of this lingo is just gobbledygook to me. And yet we've been talking already about some games that I'm obviously familiar with, things like chess. you know, and growing up, I've played all kinds of games and things like Monopoly and Trivial Pursuit. But I guess my question is, what is gaming? How do we distinguish the gaming that you guys are talking about as opposed to chess or Monopoly or other games?
Yeah, it's a valid question. And I mean, the distinction is not obviously a very fast one in the sense of, you know, there's a set, I guess, of games, a cluster that came out in the 1950s that I identify as kind of starting popular gaming as we understand it in America. Okay. And, you know, these came out at the same time as board games like Stratego and Risk had started to reach American audiences. But then there was this kind of separate class of board games. And these were made by companies like the Avalon Hill Company, being an example, who made simulations of like the Battle of Gettysburg, for example. Now, these drew on a whole rich tradition of conflict simulation that goes back to, you know, the early 19th, even the late 18th century. But these board games are the first things that kind of made it part of an American, especially youth culture movement. And those people in the 60s, as they experimented more with games, as the scope of simulation of these games started to grow, I really look at them as the first kind of gamers, as we now understand gamers, you know, people that were part of an organized fandom, a hobby that had magazines, fanzines, as they called them then, conventions, clubs, and kind of the structures that got creative people together to think about strategies for these games or to think about, you know, designing new ones themselves. And this community more or less made the jump early to computers when computer and video games started. And there are all kinds of fascinating lines of influence we can draw between the conflict simulation systems that were built for these tabletop games, especially in the 70s, and then the things we consider the first kind of computer games. And D&D was a huge part of that in the sense it was a lot of the D&D community that gave these games something that kind of transcended, I guess, the arcade game approach of, you know, pinball, you have coin operated, right. Your game should last less than 90 seconds, so the next kid has to put a quarter in, you know, and kind of made them more story driven, more of the games that are today, the kind of AAA, you know, games that are produced that, you know, like the famously Fallout 4 can make $750 million the first weekend they're released, right? Figures that make like Hollywood jealous. And so, yeah, I see that as being a kind of separate thing, largely from the traditional chess or even board games like Stratego and Risk. This was a hobby that was built, again, on more of a foundation of simulation. And that of course, made it easy for it to make the jump to computers.
There's such a fascinating aspect to gaming as a form of abstract modeling of a scenario, whatever that scenario is, whether it's a war game or a strategy, sort of tactical economic game, whatever it is, that you're basically setting up rules and trying to play out a scenario, which is an abstract model. And of course, basically what computers do is allow you to do very meticulously controlled abstract modeling as well. So I think as a big fan of computer history, I've always been fascinated by the story of the history of the game Space War, which was based on the fictional works of E.E. Doc Smith.
Also, No relation.
And he's a doctor, but he was like a doctor of food science. It's so interesting. He's treated with such veneration by early science fiction writers and readers. But his expertise was in, I think, making donuts. They're fun books.
I can get with that.
Yeah. But I was just thinking about the your book also covers the Plato system, PLATO. And there are actually at least one active Plato system still in existence that you can get logins and mess around with. And I've taken the time a few years ago to get a login and go play some of those old Plato games. And among them was a game called D&D. Which models the Dungeons & Dragons game. And it was identical to a game that was sold called Telling Guard, which you could buy at stores. And there's some really interesting history there. I might do some sort of little special bonus feature about that because there's quite a story around that. But we're really here to talk about the Monster Manual to some extent. And you wrote in your book that, I don't know why I went into that long ramble there, but I just love this stuff.
I'm happy to talk about Space War. I love Space War and Plato and all that stuff. So, yeah, I'm fascinated by it. I mean, MIT had a very vibrant conflict simulation club that was in parallel to Space War in the 1960s, and there's all these lines of interconnection between them. There's tabletop versions of Space War. Did you know that?
In the Dungeons and Dragons section, you talked about the work of T.H. White in doing a translation of a 12th century, and I'm going to say the word, is it pronounced bestiary or bestiary? I've always been a little unclear on that. Like, it's primer and primer.
We usually say bestiary these days. We usually say bestiary.
Okay, so he's looking at a 12th century bestiary, T.H. White is, and he makes a translation of it, and that somehow becomes part of the sort of the monster manual in some way. Is this a Gary Gygax thing? How did this happen? What's the relationship between those books?
Yeah, I mean, this is kind of a long story in some respects, but I mean, the Monster Manual, remember, came out about 3 years after D&D was first published, right? There was kind of this original box set of D&D that came out in 1974, and the Monster Manual kind of began to show where the game was evolving towards. It was the first book in what we call the Advanced Dungeons and Dragons series. And it is its own bestiary, right? It's a compendium of 350 monsters that have been researched and so on. But when you wind the clock back just, you know, 3 more years to 1974, I mean, you'll find that, you know, Gary Gygax and his compatriots, people like Dave Arneson, who are working on D&D, you know, they knew monsters largely from fantasy fiction, right? They knew monsters from having read Tolkien or Robert E. Howard or Poul Anderson. And, you know, T.H. White obviously had written a book called Once and Future King that was pretty well known in fantasy circles at the time. And so his work became one of several sources that they ended up raiding to find more monsters to populate their dungeons and wildernesses, because there was a voracious appetite for new things to slay and overcome. And so, you know, when you look at what we started with in D&D, it's a pretty small set compared to what's in the Monster Manual, but a lot of those things are things that they found then in T.H. White, and there's a book that's called A Fantastic Bestiary that's by Lehner, that is another thing, has an index in the back that we can tell they raided to kind of cobble together some of the first monsters that they put forward. And so it was, I think, a real mashup. It was a mashup of, okay, I read this pulpy, you know, fantasy novel, and this is how Poul Anderson think trolls work, and so we're going to have trolls be like this. But then I was watching some Harryhausen animated Sinbad or Jason and the Argonauts, and you had skeletons and this iron golem and like all these amazing things in it, and they just drew from absolutely everything they could find.
So I think Blake is getting very excited about this topic, and he's concerned that maybe we've made too much of a big jump and that we should pull back and go back to the beginnings a little bit more. So maybe if we could talk about how we've gone from games like chess to war gaming and to Dungeons and Dragons, and how that progression's
I got a little over.
Okay.
I like this stuff a lot, but we probably should contextualize it.
You can edit this any way you want and put it together, right? So
yeah. True.
So.
So we can talk a bit about chess and war games and things like that. When I started trying to figure out the origins of simulation, the origins of the idea that people, you know, would use kind of probability and implements of chance to decide fictional events in a way that was based on some kind of like scientific model, you know, it took me back to Prussian Kriegsspiel. And so the Kriegsspiel that was developed in Germany, the Kriegsspiel is a word that just means war game. The Kriegsspiel tradition in Germany sprang from chess. There's a whole era in, I guess, the early modern Renaissance period where people viewed chess as a tool for learning statecraft, a tool for strategy, a tool for just indoctrinating people into, you know, proper ways of bolstering defenses and making attacks. You know, it just is an abstract training tool. But a lot of people found that unsatisfactory. There were military scientists who wanted to try to adapt chess into something that would more accurately reflect what a contemporary battlefield was like. Because let's face it, you know, the veering bishops and the rooks that shuffle along, and you know, the queen who can dominate the field, and the king who can kind of only cower in his castle, you know, aren't necessarily reflective of the infantry, artillery, and cavalry that they had, say, in the 17th century even. And so people started looking at, can we adapt the chessboard? Can we make the chessboard bigger for one thing. So it's not just this 8x8 grid, but, you know, maybe it should be a 100x100 grid. And maybe we should be able to people it with pieces that move the way that infantry moves today, or that can, you know, or cavalry that can move faster than infantry, or artillery that can shoot at things from a distance, and to develop systems for, you know, maneuvering in this and resolving events that would actually train people to be able to do to prosecute real wars at the time.
Cool. That's interesting. We're using the term interesting a lot tonight.
Yeah.
Well, but I mean it.
Well, I remember as a child, fairly young, going to some of our bigger malls. And one of them had a store called Sword of the Phoenix, which sold role-playing games, because this was late 70s. But they also were still primarily selling tabletop wargaming stuff, and there were all kinds of, you know, metal miniatures. I assume they were lead back then. I'm not really sure, but and I knew that people were playing some kind of game, but I really wasn't clear on how you played a game and how much of it was just about painting minis. And I'm still sometimes, when I look at people playing Warhammer, I'm not still quite sure how much of it is about painting miniatures and how much of it's about trying to win battles. But it does seem to be a broad spectrum of styles and approaches that kind of combines a lot of different sort of hobbies that can be met, like sort of things you can do with these hobbies. I mean, some people really like role-playing games to take on roles and do acting and improv scenes. And some people like to do really intense tactical combat. And some people like to paint miniatures. It's a broad spectrum of pastimes, I guess, all bundled into one big title gaming hobby, right?
Oh, fair enough. Yeah. And I mean, if you go back to the origin of what we consider hobby wargaming, you know, H.G. Wells is the first name that you come to, because Wells proposed a way of using toy soldiers of the kind that, you know, you would have in a typical middle class British nursery of his day, and kind of being able to marshal those in something that approximates those more complex, like Prussian kinds of games, but is, you know, easy to resolve and, you know, very playable, as we say, not so much focused on the realism. The simulation of events as the playability of just being able to kind of resolve things and have a fun tactical battle. And, you know, once miniatures got into the equation, there were a number of firms that became very interested in developing rules for miniature war games, in the sense that, you know, if you look at a company like Avalon Hill that sold basically board games in the 1950s, you know, everything you needed to play was in the box. You bought the box, you had everything you needed to do in order to play the game. But, you know, somebody like Jack Scrooby, who in the 1950s was manufacturing military miniatures in California, you know, he wanted to develop rules in order to encourage people to buy his miniatures, right? Because if you need to buy 200 miniatures in order to field this battle, you know, then Jack Scrooby has a nice payday. And so for him, rules were something that kind of joined together, you know, the process of buying these figures, painting them, and then playing with them.
So at some point, I guess the general narrative is, you've got very serious tactical models and serious board games based on trying to recreate military battles and that sort of thing. And then you've got the Gary Gygax and Dave Arneson people who want to add fantasy, you know, throw a wizard out there with the other people. Is that an oversimplification? Is that how we got to Dungeons and Dragons out of the wargaming world?
It's certainly a big part of it. You know, in 1971, Gary Gygax released what was the first kind of commercial set of rules for fantasy gaming. It was a game called Chainmail that he wrote with a guy named Jeff Perrin. And Perrin had developed a medieval combat system. A lot of the war games that were popular in the 60s were really focused on much later periods of history. They were focused on refighting things from the Civil War, from World War I, from World War II. Going back to medieval rules was rarer. There were a few people who were doing it, but not many. And, you know, what they ended up doing was tacking on this fantasy supplement to this book, Chainmail. It was about a third of the book, so it wasn't, you know, just a couple pages they stapled onto the end. But this was the first place they detailed, here's rules for an orc or a wizard or a dragon or, you know, things like that. And they drew, again, largely on Tolkien, on Robert E. Howard's Conan books, a bit on Michael Moorcock and things like that. And that created the initial impetus for fantasy gaming as kind of an industry in America in 1971.
Okay. So for me, who's outside of the community and not really familiar with any of the monsters of Dungeons & Dragons, could you tell us about some of the most iconic monsters? And I'm wondering if I might know of some just through history or just through hearing about these characters.
Yeah, I mean, you know, orcs are big in D&D, orcs and kobolds and dragons and things like that. They're, you know, the ones that became most iconic, frankly, are probably ones that were invented for the game. Good examples of this would be like the Mind Flayer, who's kind of a Cthulhu-like guy. Who's got like tentacles for a mouth, and he's he has psionic abilities, so he can mind blast you, things like that. Or another would be the Beholder, which is this kind of floating sphere with eyes on stalks. It has these eight eye stalks on its head, and then this one huge central eye in the middle of the spherical body. And each of its little eye stalks can shoot rays that have different effects in the game. They're all bad. You don't want to get hit by any of them.
Sounds a bit like the flying spaghetti monster.
It's a bit. Some of us are true believers there. But, if you look at, for example, the current monster manual, the one that's been released for 5th edition Dungeons & Dragons, the Beholder is on the cover. It has become one of the most iconic D&D monsters.
Okay.
At some point, they took this concept of a bestiary and created the monster manual. And it sounds like they're mining just about anything in order to get material, right? So can you talk about the first versions of the book and how it's changed over time?
Sure. So, I mean, the first version was really trying to gather a bunch of stuff that had unfortunately been scattered across a pretty wide spread of periodicals, rule books, supplements, and things like it. So, you know, the reason they had to do a compendium, a real kind of taxonomic compendium for these monsters, was because they'd been, you know, they had this magazine, they called it The Dragon, for example, and there would be monsters in each issue of The Dragon. But if you're trying to remember when you're playing the game where a given monster was that in the Greyhawk supplement? Was that in Eldritch Wizardry? Was that in the original game? Was that in Dragon number 3? You know, you had a significant problem. And so the AD&D system, of which the Monster Manual was the first installment, really just tried to gather all that together. Now, they did add some things in for it. Frankly, most of the things they added, you know, it was like dinosaurs or, you know, you need rules for like a badger. You know, there's a lot of just kind of animals, frankly, that got added at that stage of it. And, you know, they were just trying to be complete, to provide a complete simulation of the kinds of monsters that you would encounter. Inevitably, as soon as it came out, though, people were coming up with more. You know, more issues of The Dragon were published, and so there was this magazine in the UK called White Dwarf that was affiliated at the time with the people who published D&D, and they had their own column that was dedicated to introducing new monsters in every issue, and those ended up getting bound into a volume called The Fiend Folio, which came out in 1981. And then enough monsters have been published, you know, 2 years later that they had a Monster Manual 2. And, you know, the Monster Manual 2 had an index for where you could find monsters across the original Monster Manual and the Fiend Folio and the Monster Manual 2. And it just gets worse from here. Like every edition of D&D that was published subsequently, there would be an original Monster Manual, but then there would be, you know, all these additions you could get to it. They actually, in second edition, it's interesting, they basically just gave you a binder that you could clip more pages into and then sold just more pages, you know, 3-hole binder ready that you could stick into your binder, and, you know, you could fill multiple binders with all the monsters that they ended up defining.
Wow. I mean, I've heard of Red Dwarf, not White Dwarf, though.
Yes.
I'm not sure if you guys are familiar with that.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I feel out of my depth here talking about these topics. I think a question that's come to mind is, I'm just trying to think, because, again, I haven't been a part of the community in any way, but when I was growing up in Australia, when I was a kid in the 1980s, I'd hear a lot about Dungeons and Dragons, and adults talking about it and the news media talking about it. And it just seemed like there was a lot of negativity surrounding it at that point, and that it was just seen as something that people became obsessive about and was a very bad thing in some way and had lots of negative connotations and links to, I guess, Satanism and all kinds of things related to that. So I'm just wondering, what is the link to that? Again, these are just things that I'd kind of hear in the background without being involved in any way. But I think that the, something that Blake wanted to talk about was the relation to the satanic panic in the 1980s.
Oh, for sure. Yeah.
But yeah,
I grew up in that time. Yeah. So
Why was it looked down upon by so many parents, and what was the problem with D&D?
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
Hello, I'm Paul Giamatti.
And I'm Stephen Asma.
Each week on Chinwag, we dig into the weird topics you wonder about, that you care about. The stuff none of us are totally sure of, like the Bermuda Triangle, Mothman, consciousness, philosophy, UFOs, ghosts, or say, Bigfoot.
So who's to say that there's not alien species that are Sasquatch?
Like I'd seen a ghost, and I would hear something walking and breathing.
Maybe every path is right. I will accept as a premise that every path is right.
That is a face on Mars. Eyes, nose. It kind of looked like Wilson the volleyball.
Some people enjoy the waves or whatever crashing, and I enjoy listening to a quantum physics audiobook.
I do think there are many things in the world that we just don't understand and probably won't understand.
That's our whole show.
So join us every Wednesday on all major podcast platforms and find us on Instagram, TikTok, and Twitter at ChinwagPod and Wagon.
I mean, D&D probably would have remained a pretty obscure hobby. It wouldn't have crossed into the mainstream if it weren't for this one bizarre historical accident. When in 1979, there was a kid who was a university student in East Lansing, Michigan, who disappeared from his dorm room. And the media, the kind of private detective who'd been hired to try to find him, became fixated on the fact that he played D&D. And they believed that D&D was responsible for his disappearance, that he had become convinced that this was real, and that he was, in fact, wandering the steam tunnels beneath the university trying to slay monsters and find treasure and things like that. And that if he were and had been gone for so long, he'd probably been killed by it. And this became front page news for about a week on newspapers, lead stories on nightly news in America. It was this huge, huge media circus. Now, of course, it turned out he had run away and was in Louisiana. And eventually, when he heard about all this, he called his parents and, you know, kind of came home. But that created this dialogue, this narrative about D&D. And that narrative would be borrowed by a lot of religious fundamentalists over the coming years that were kind of dovetailing this all with the satanic panic, as you described. Right. And there were a whole series of these guys who published these tracts about it, who petitioned school boards to ban it. And, you know, they certainly had the microphone of the media and were able to, promulgate those ideas far enough that they, I'm sure, reached Australia and were part of the dialogue there as well.
It's just interesting to hear about how that kind of diffusion across to other countries. And I wasn't familiar with that original story.
Oh yeah, it's a classic because the way it was described at the time sounded so weird. That's not the gaming world that I had seen. Nobody was dressing up. Yet it, in many ways, they're really describing early LARPing. So the live action role playing. But I ran into a Jack Chick track for Dark Dungeons before I ever saw a Player's Handbook or any of the other gaming materials.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So that was, growing up in a small town in Georgia, they had a delightful selection of Jack Chick tracks in my doctor's office when I would have to go to the pediatrician. So,
I ironically collected those when I was a kid. I thought they were great. I'm sure I still have them all somewhere in a folder.
I mean, this is sad because, I mean, I think it was harmful to the hobby, but I absolutely loved the story there because the implication, which is actually one that weirdly still goes on, which is the implication is that if you're playing Dungeons & Dragons or whatever the Dark Dungeons game is in Jack Chick's Twisted Imagination, you're really learning how to do real magic and you're opening yourself up to a gateway where you're going to go down the path of, you know, demon subjugation and, you know, dark satanic cults and that sort of thing, which is, I have to say, if you're a person who's a seeker looking for power and you think you're going to get that out of a Dungeons and Dragons book, it's kind of disappointing to see it's roll dice, creature takes 2d6 damage. You know, it's like, what?
I study this quite a bit. I mean, this is one of the things, since it's so integral to the history of D&D, that I've kind of endlessly poured through. And, you know, the fascinating thing about it is that when the D&D, when the designers of the game decided to integrate in, especially real-world mythology to it, after the Monster Manual, the next book that was kind of a compendium like it, they released was something called Deities and Demigods.
Mm-hmm.
And this came out, you know, in 1980, right around the time the Satanic Panic was kicking off, and it contained detailed descriptions of mythological, quote-unquote, but real-world pantheons of gods. Now, it was mixed in, you know, there's like Lovecraft's Cthulhu stuff, there's Elric's Melniboné stuff, but then there's, you know, Norse mythology, which does detail pagan things, right? And if you're a fundamentalist Christian and you're seeing your child leaping through this thing that's discussing, you know, what to you is paganism, I don't think it's entirely, you know, surprising that you would say maybe there, you know, is there something to this, right?
Yeah,
I think we had on Joe Laycock, who's a religious studies professor, and he wrote a book called
his book. Yeah,
he wrote Dangerous Games, and we talked a little bit about I guess there was a rumor at the time that there were stats in the book for Jesus, and that really upset a lot of people, which I think it's just, I don't know. Moral panics are, you know, they always are completely disturbing and compelling when you're in the middle of them, and they are ridiculous in retrospect, you know. And,
well, I mean, yeah, Gary and Dave, the chief designers of D&D, they were both Christians. They both seriously self-identified as Christians. Mm-hmm. And, you know, they certainly thought this was absolutely ridiculous, that there was nothing to any of this notion that you're learning real magic or something. But at the same time, you know, the month that James Dallas Egbert disappeared, that kid in East Lansing, Michigan, you know, that issue of the Dragon was giving stats for Satan. Right.
Like, wow.
You know, it's so I don't want to make the case of the fundamentalists on this, but at least I can understand, you know, what some of their concerns were.
I'm sorry to interrupt, but what are stats? Statistics.
This is a good question.
This is a good question. And this gets into what
is it?
Makes.
I've stumbled across it.
No, so, I mean, this gets into what makes the way that D&D looks at monsters so unique and so influential in some respects, because monsters, you know, in literature can be pretty vague. You know, when Tolkien talks about the Balrog, for example, famously, people argue about whether or not he meant it had wings. And nobody can decide if it's supposed to have wings or not, because he describes it as a shadow, and, you know, there's really not a lot of concrete detail. But to put a monster into a simulation, it has to be specific enough to simulate. Right? You have to know enough about it that the game system can interact with the monster. And so what stats are? Stats are the quantification of attributes of a monster that let you confront it or charm it or, you know, interact with it in the system in some way. So these will be things like its hit points. Hit points are something that's came from D&D, is tremendously influential in computer gaming. You know, it's kind of the bucket of endurance you have to withstand damage. And it's always quantified in D&D. So when you start out, you know, you might have just 5 or 6 hit points, and a sword might be able to kill you with a single blow. But if you're fighting a dragon, you know, a dragon could have hundreds of hit points. And so if you were fighting it with a sword, you might need to hit it hundreds of times to be able to defeat it. And that aspect of how D&D approaches monsters made people have to, you know, reify them in a way that really you don't have to if you're just creating a myth or even writing fiction about it. You have to make it real enough to simulate.
And so who creates these stats, and are they something that evolve over time?
They do. So, I mean, if you look across the multiple editions of D&D, even what the stats are changes a bit over time. But it's a designer's game, a designer's job. The game designer stipulates what stats are. But that much said, everybody who plays the game is a little bit of a game designer themselves. Everybody invents their own monsters. But you kind of use the prototypes you see in something like the Monster Manual, where you can see what it's like to be something very powerful like a dragon, or something very weak like a kobold, right? And you can kind of, you know, okay, I think my monster should be a little bigger than a kobold, but nowhere near as big as a dragon, and so I'm going to give it this number of hit points, I'm going to give it this armor class. When it hits you, it's going to do this much damage, and there are die rolls that you incorporate into the system to kind of stipulate how many hit points of damage a given hit against a player character would do.
Structural rule set so that everybody's playing on the same basis. Everyone has the same platform from which to approach the problem solving. And in as you play with different groups, everyone wants to have a different character. So there's these different character classes who have certain advantages and disadvantages. And then Dungeons & Dragons has a magic system. So the people who use magic typically start out weaker in physical combat, but stronger in magical ability. And there's just like, it's just a fascinating sort of,
I can see why this would appeal to our listeners with the combination of history and mythology and monsters and legends.
And problem solving. And it's got, and there's usually pizza, I think, that, and that's always nice. And so.
For sure.
It's funny, the project, one of the projects that I'm working on now, it's actually about to be released next month, is a cookbook for Dungeons & Dragons. True story.
You cook the pizza same team. And Chinese food.
So, you know, if you want to eat the tavern-style meals that D&D adventurers would eat, then you can find recipes for it in our cookbook.
Oh, that's fun.
Ye old lords and ladies, have a turkey leg. What?
Well, there's a really good show. I'm not sure if you guys are familiar with it on YouTube. It's called Tasting History. And I can't remember the guy's name, Max Miller or something. And he goes and looks at historical cookbooks and makes recipes from these cookbooks, and then goes into the history behind these foods and the people who ate them. So it's pretty interesting.
Oh, that is interesting. Yeah. I think you'll find, like, within different gaming groups, you have some people who want to just, you know, power grab and, you know, get the most treasure, which is not a real thing. Obviously, it's imaginary treasure, but things that you win through combat or cleverness, you can use to make your character more powerful, which changes your stats, which, you know, makes it possible to get more treasure and so on. But some people want to achieve, like, political goals within this imaginary system. And some people just want to have exciting fun and drama. Some people just want to do Monty Python quotes and distract from the progress.
I can do that.
It's the great thing about a system like D&D. I mean, it really, to play it is always to reinvent it. You know, it's a set of guidelines, right, that the people sitting around the table can use to have the kind of experience they want to have. And there is always some push and pull. There's usually some tension between what some people at the table might want to do and what other people want to do. But the aggregate of that creates this extremely artisanal and personal experience as you kind of collaboratively make these adventure stories work.
So is this the kind of thing that you get together with a group of friends and do? Or is it you join groups and communities or it can be online, and so you're meeting people from all around the world. How does it work?
I mean, obviously these days the online dimension is a bit more prevalent than it used to be, but it really is mostly you get together with your friends, I'd say. There's a certain amount of, like, convention play, even tournament play. Early on, especially when the game was still closer to its wargaming roots, there were these highly competitive tournaments you'd be able to play at conventions, and they would, you know, declare a winner who was most successful at looting this particular dungeon adventure that had been designed for it. But yeah, I mean, it is an extremely diverse set of people that get involved with it, and so these days, Zoom games or WebEx games are very common. Yeah. There are even sets of online tools like Roll20 that are designed to kind of provide the framework you need, the die rolling mechanics, the ability to show maps to position where monsters and characters are in a given room in an underground labyrinth, right? Things like that.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And that's become a very vibrant part of the community, especially since we all entered this in unending quarantine.
And is there a culture of people who don't really like to play but like to watch and be a part of the audience?
Apparently. Definitely. So. Yeah.
This has become huge. I mean, if you want to see the apogee of that community, take a look at something called Critical Role. Critical Role, it's a number of professional voice actors, largely people who are well known for doing voices for absolutely revered computer game series like, you know, the Persona series, a Japanese series that's very popular, you know, got together and ran a campaign and just filmed themselves running this campaign. They become superstars. They have a Kickstarter for an animated series based on it that was the most successful media Kickstarter of all time.
Wow.
The game is run by a game master who is sort of the rules arbitrator for the whole session. And it's also sort of the storyteller, yet it's at the same time, it's a collaborative storytelling environment. So each character is telling their own story and also helping push forward the narrative in a perfect world. Sometimes there's disruptive people, but yeah. And so you might go to the store and buy an adventure module. And the idea there is there's a narrative sort of skeleton there with like information on the monsters you're going to encounter, the treasure and the plot points. And then the GM or Dungeon Master will walk the people through that narrative, and collaboratively it will produce an outcome of some sort or another. And every time you play that scenario with different people, or even with the same people if they want to replay it, it'll be a different game because their characters will be different characters or they'll say different things. And so even though you're seeing the same kind of story, they all seem to kind of come out differently. From a pure entertainment point of view, it's an endless wealth of variety available.
Yeah, it's super hard to explain, but it's really easy to do.
Yeah.
You know, so like Karen, let's just say that you have a character who's a wizard and you can come up with a name for your character. Like, you know,
Pie Wacket.
There you go.
Pie Wacket.
That's a real witch name. Yep. Well, sort it's a real name of witches,
Matthew
right?
Witchfinder poster.
Oh, nice.
Yeah.
Oh, very nice. But, you know, just imagine your character, you know, at the start of, you know, set of stairs leading down into a dungeon, and the dungeon master will describe to you, well, you know, it looks like it goes down about 20 feet and it ends in a wooden door. The wooden door, you know, has a knocker on it. And we'll just ask you, what do you do? And as a player, you say, well, okay, I walk down the staircase and, you know, I knock on the knocker or, you know, try to pry the door open. Or, you know, if you're a wizard, you could maybe cast a spell like the knock spell that will just open the door magically. Mm-hmm. And you just kind of negotiate these things through this way. And
storytelling, really.
Yes.
It's storytelling. So, you're constantly being prompted, okay, here's the environment, what do you do? That's what the dungeon master, the referee does. And the players then just each decide for themselves, well, I'm ignoring this staircase. I'm going to try to go around to the other side of the building. Is there some kind of a window or other way I can get in? And you might have to roll a check in order to determine that. You'd roll a 20-sided die for like a perception check of some kind. And, you know, maybe you'll spot there is a window. It's 50 feet up though. And maybe you have a rope, maybe you have a grappling hook, you know, depending on what equipment you bring to it. And so it's extremely open-ended. And it has just this immense creativity to it, but it's also incredibly immersive to play it. It's really easy to just kind of get into the spirit of it and imagine yourself in the situation of this person. And all you really need to know of the rules to play, for the most part, is kind of what you would propose a person in that situation would do. As long as you can describe it, then the dungeon master will tell you what the result is.
And it sounds like you've done this before, John.
Once or twice, yeah.
Well, and it would be possible. I mean, you could have games with no magic. You can have games that are set in modern times. And you can have games, and I don't know why anybody would, but you could have games with no monsters at all. But
That doesn't make sense. Even
this quickly branched out into science fiction. You know, there was a number of titles, some that came right on the heels of Star Wars, for example, that imagined psionic powers like the Force. There were games that took this to the Old West. Old West setting was very popular, to post-apocalyptic mutant kind of settings, mm-hmm. where, you know, you may have atomic mutations and superpowers from that. Tons of superhero games, historical games, pretty much any genre that you can imagine being a source of adventure. People have adapted for role-playing game by this point.
Sounds pretty cool.
Well, you know, your mileage may vary. One of the things is a good portion of how much fun you have is related to the sort of personalities and qualities of the friends that you play with. So I would not give up on the game if you have a bad experience your first time. You might want to just swap out game groups. You know, I mean, you might have to find the right group of people to play with. But that suits your taste. And that's not to say anyone's doing it wrong necessarily. It's just that you got to find people who are willing to play the way you want to play and that you can get along with. And I think on the online world, even though I like to sit down with people and have pizza and throw real dice, it seems like the online world is a really great way to meet people in a variety of places. And I'm sure, based on reading the Facebook group and other things, that we have tons of gamers in the Monster Truck listener audience that probably, if they don't know each other, would really enjoy playing with each other in this sort of these sort of virtual worlds.
Definitely.
So, have there been any push? This is just a really meta question, but have there been any pushes to establish sort of like realistic biological ecosystems in the sort of Dungeons and Dragons worlds? When I was growing up, you know, you'd see these random encounter type, you know, classic dungeon crawls where one room to the next, the monsters didn't seem to know what was going on. They seem like entirely generated by random encounters. But I've always, like, I just always imagined, you know, being a biologist in this sort of world, trying to figure out what the ecosystem is exactly. And I know it's kind of complicated by magic, but are there like more naturalistic magic world building efforts out there?
Definitely. So there was a classic series actually that ran in Dragon Magazine, which is the magazine TSR, the people that publish D&D, put out every month. It was on the ecology of various monsters that would answer precisely these questions, try to explain how an ecosystem of these monsters would actually thrive in a dungeon environment, and you know where they lived, what they ate, you know how they reproduced. It's been practically Aristotle's generation of animals. An immense amount of attention has been lavished on this over the years.
In my youth, I thought it was weird that at the same time we were having the Satanic Panic and people were burning role-playing books, we also had the Dungeons and Dragons cartoon.
I am Dungeon Master, your guide in the realm of Dungeons and Dragons.
How did we have a world where we're simultaneously getting our first sort of on-screen D&D role-playing product, and at the same time, people are completely freaking out about role-playing games?
It is fascinating that the D&D cartoon came out at the time that it did. I mean, this was a time when Gary Gygax personally was in Hollywood, was trying to get a D&D movie made. He had a script for it. He was pushing hard to get major studios interested in it. And around that time, they developed a partnership with Marvel Comics, actually. And it was through their work with Marvel, and this was, they were doing series of comic books. They were doing little figurines that were based on designs Marvel was doing. You know, really, the D&D cartoon was born of that partnership. And yeah, I mean, there's some irony that there's a famous 60 Minutes where Ed Bradley has on someone named Patricia Pulling, who is really probably the most visible figure in the pushback against D&D. She was the founder of a group called Bad Bothered About Dungeons and Dragons, you know, who was very assiduously working to try to see D&D banned everywhere that it could be. And at the same time, CBS is like airing that. You know, in the morning, they're airing the D&D cartoon show. And so, I mean, I think this was based on the fact that the demographic for D&D in the early 1980s started to shift sharply younger. And so when they were looking at how they were going to expand the audience for the game, having something like a Saturday morning cartoon show was just a natural place to expand. And, you know, it was like half an hour commercials for your product, as many Saturday morning cartoons were in retrospect. You look back at, you know, Transformers, or, you know, take your pick of how many of these were really kind of product placement. You know, this was a way to get younger children engaged with D&D. And, you know, although there was definitely a countercurrent against that, there were people who were extremely concerned about the influence of D&D over young people at the time. You know, those people weren't responsible for scheduling major television networks, you know, and so with the combined might of D&D, which was then already a pretty substantial business, and Marvel, it was just going to happen.
So the game's called Dungeons and Dragons. So why do monsters love dungeons so much?
Good question. I mean, if you look at The Hobbit, I mean, you know, Smaug kind of lived underground on a big pile of treasure there, right? And there is that dwarven song about the dungeons deep and caverns old.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Tolkien suffuses so much of this, necessarily, because Tolkien was so monumentally popular at the time that D&D came out. D&D kind of rode the coattails of his particular vision of fantasy a bit. If you look at The Hobbit is really, you know, a quest story about going and getting, you know, loot and magic rings and magic swords called Sting and defeating lots of orcs and goblins on your way to finally confront the dragon at the very end. Episodically, I mean, I think it looks very much like D&D does.
I keep thinking, every time I hear about The Hobbit, I think about the movie that they did and how that I could easily read the book before I could finish watching all those movies. It's crazy. So it's like a little padded.
I mean, to give a slightly more technical answer to that one, too, I mean, the dungeon as a place of adventure is really interesting to add to war games. Because, you know, a traditional war game, you played it like on a board or on a sand table or some kind of terrain you'd set up to put your miniatures on to play the game. And bringing it down into this dungeon space where it is paper and pencil, and a big part of the game becomes exploration. It becomes, you know, the dungeon master telling you, well, there's a corridor ahead of you and it extends for 30 feet and then it forks and you can either go right or left. What do you do?
Mm-hmm.
And people would draw these maps of this, right, on graph paper just based on the verbal description they were getting. So they wouldn't get lost. They could find their way out is one reason for it. But, you know, to kind of make sure that they're making the progress they want to. And that exploration component to it certainly was a huge part of its appeal and is something that every computer game that includes dungeon crawls, these are the Diablos, the Elder Scrolls, games like this, have really followed that model ever since, because it just provides a compelling experience.
That just reminds me of the book series, Choose Your Own Adventure.
Oh, yeah.
I used to read some of those. I mean, it was more something my brother was into. He's a little older than me, but I remember it seems like a very similar format to that anyway.
Yeah, and actually some of the, it was probably only 2 years after D&D came out that the first people started combining game books, you know, these kind of multi-path adventure books, with role-playing games. Famously, a company called Flying Buffalo, who produced one of the earliest competitors to D&D, pretty derivative one in some respects, called Tunnels and Trolls. The Tunnels and Trolls people had a game book that was called Buffalo Castle. It came out in 76, so
wow.
Really around the time that the first Choose Your Own Adventure books, yeah, I mean, they hadn't even developed a brand yet, but Edward Packard and those guys had started writing the initial books around then. There was an earlier UK book series called Tracker Books that were game books like that before we had Choose Your Own Adventure in America. But, like, you know, Buffalo Castle incorporated into that kind of decision model of Choose Your Own Adventure. Yes, I go into this room. What do? You meet this monster. And if you meet the monster, here's the system for how you fight it and decide if you beat it or it beat you. And, you know, that's kind of what they layered on top of the game book format.
I found all this really interesting. I regret having not finished your book before we talked, but everything I read in it was absolutely fascinating. I think would be of great interest to our listeners. This whole field of gaming, and not just the gaming itself, but thinking about the history of it and how these various models were utilized for play and for, you know, in some ways just simulation, right? I think it's just really just endlessly fascinating. So I really appreciate you writing the book and for taking the time to talk to us tonight.
Well, it's my pleasure. No, thanks for having me. No,
it's a big topic.
Someone like me, a primer on the topic.
Absolutely. Yeah,
and if you want to do an intro game, we can get it on Zoom for an hour. I can lead you through it. You'll get it immediately. Everybody gets it first try.
If there's alcohol involved, sounds good.
It's like I just want to know what Matthew will think if you get online and start doing role playing. This will be the best. I need to see his reaction.
I just don't know if he's. I don't even know if he's into that kind of thing.
That's interesting.
He doesn't ever really talk about it. But
well, I hope we've opened up a new avenue for your marriage, Karen. Is what I. Well,
I can say so many things, but I won't.
Well, John, we have a signature question, and I know this is an unfair question because if someone asked me, I would be challenged to answer it. But here we go. What is your favorite monster?
I mean, like a D&D monster?
It's
or
whatever
monster?
You want it to be.
Anything.
Like anything that you classify as a monster. You don't have to give stats for it, but there will be an encounter that we'll have to play. No.
I mean, so taxonomically, do you consider Totoro to be a monster?
Yes, I like Totoro. Absolutely. Yeah. And a neighbor. He's a neighbor and a monster, I think.
That's right.
Is that your answer?
That's my answer.
That's a great answer. So
I haven't had that one before.
You know, I ran into Totoro, not really, but I ran into the video back in the early 90s. I guess there was like an initial American release with like entirely different voice actors from the Disney re-release they did later. And so like I knew Totoro, but then like I got reintroduced to Totoro with like an entirely different cast. It was so peculiar. So yeah. But I love all the Studio Ghibli stuff. But that is, yeah, that's a great answer.
I mean, maybe the cat bus comes in second.
Oh, cat bus is awesome. You know, it's most of our listeners are adult. Have you ever noticed the cat bus has testicles?
Well, I mean, this is a Japanese thing. Right.
My daughter got a cat bus action figure I don't know whatever you would call it, a very accurate rendition of the cat bus and I was like, oh, that's cool. The cat bus. And I flipped it. I don't remember the cat bus having truck nuts, but there they are. So that was surprising. I didn't notice it in the cartoon, but I don't think they would have put them on the toy if they weren't in the cartoon. So
probably not.
I'll go check it later. That's just the kind of deep science, cuts you get here on Monster Talk. All right.
Yeah.
Exactly. Well, John,
this has
thanks.
Been a lot of fun learning about all of this. It's definitely a new world to explore.
It's a huge world, but you know, it's probably the place most people encounter monsters these days is in gaming. You know, monsters are a part of people's everyday life because of gaming.
Such a good point, yeah.
If you're interested in and concerned about monsters, for many people, the Monster Manual or these kind of books are the first place you go to find out how to combat them in case they show up in real life, you know? I mean, yeah, that's silly on the one hand, but in another real sense, I think for people, putting stats to a monster and knowing its weaknesses helps them cope. So I think there's some therapeutic value there.
Well, and if you've seen How to Train Your Dragon, right, there's one of the kids who's learning to be a dragon slayer who really quotes chapter and verse from their monster manual, all the stats, everything for each of the dragons as they're learning to combat them. So, yeah, the influence of that has cast a pretty long shadow.
It has indeed. Well, thank you so much for taking time to talk to us. We will...
Yeah, thank you, John. I can see my five-year-old getting into this someday.
Almost, yeah, guaranteed.
Never too young. Never too young.
So we'll put links to those two books in the show notes. Is there anything else you want us to link to or anything you're working on you want to talk about, let the listeners know about?
I mentioned that we're doing this cookbook that's called Heroes Feast that is coming out for the holidays this time in case you want to cook your D&D. Unfortunately, you know, we did have to make substitutions for any of the recipes that involved monster parts. But you will certainly see plenty of references to monsters in it. I also have a book coming out at the end of this year from MIT Press called The Elusive Shift that is about role-playing games and how people started to understand them as a genre separate from war games.
Did you say The Elusive Shift?
Elusive Shift.
Got it.
You can find it. It's up on the Amazons and everything if you want to link it.
I will link it. We will.
Congratulations.
Yeah.
No, thanks. Yeah.
That's fantastic. What have you tried the recipes in Heroes Feast?
I have, though for the most part, I've made drinks personally. We have a drink section. And so we actually have a drink called the Mind Flayer, for example. and I can, it is like a vodka slushy. It will flay your mind if you
drink
it.
Nice.
But yeah, we actually did photo shoots with this with professional preppers and photographers and prop people and things like that. And so since I was there for the photo shoots, I got to eat a lot of these things kind of as we were shooting them, which was a blast. Yeah.
Did you have a favorite recipe? Or is that the sort of thing you don't tell? I've never talked about a cookbook before. I mean,
I know,
of course I have. My wife collects thousands of them, but I mean, I've never talked to an author of a cookbook before about the book. So is that a fair question? Like, was there a preferred, like a recipe you're really proud of?
We have a lot of good mushroom recipes. Like we have a drow mushroom steak. We're kind of trying to simulate what food would be like if you lived underground in caves. And
like
so
foraging.
You know, yeah, foraging mushrooms, things like that. And so that's a favorite of mine.
The problem with all those Underdark recipes is they make me drowsy.
Oh, terrible, terrible. So your pun budget is now you have spent it.
Yeah.
Monster Talk.
You've been listening to Monster Talk, the science show about monsters. I'm Blake Smith.
And I'm Karen Stolzner.
You've been listening to an interview with author John Peterson, author of Playing at the World, and a contributor to the D&D Art and Arcana book. And he's also the author of a new gaming-themed cookbook, Heroes Feast, which we will also link to in the show notes. We hope you've enjoyed this episode of Monster Talk. Each episode, we strive to bring you the very best in monster-related content with a focus on bringing scientific skepticism into the conversation. If you enjoy Monster Talk, we now have a variety of ways to support the show, all with convenient links at monstertalk.org/support. That's monstertalk.org/support. We have links there to our Patreon page as well as a donation button. Another great way to support the show is to buy books from our Amazon Monster Talk wish list, which directly helps us with our research. We love used books very much, so don't feel compelled to buy new ones. And we love Kindle, so we can share our digital libraries with each other. And finally, without spending any money at all, you can support us by leaving a positive review at iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. Positive reviews help keep us visible in iTunes, which is a great way to help us find new listeners. And please share our show on your favorite social media platforms. Monster Talk theme music is by Pete Stealing Monkeys. Thank you so much for listening and for your support.
Been a Monster House presentation.
Well, there's got to be a town nearby. We will go to that town and ask around about a Pegasus. Huzzah!
Is that right?
And so it was that the group began to describe themselves walking. And as they described themselves walking, so did Obed confirm they walked.
I walk with them.